Papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where we look at what's going on in the news media, the mainstream media, and elsewhere these days, and offer some insights into ethical decision making in the newsroom with some veteran local journalists. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now publishing the Upstate American. Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette, Schenectady, and Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy. How are we today? Everybody okay?
Hey, I'm ready for another round.
No. You can only do that when it's a new listener.
A new listener or an angel got its wings. They left the bell in the studio with us.
We're outlaws here, folks. We're outlaws. Speaking of which, you talk outlawed language. Some of the things we can't say on this program. For example, there are certain words that, you know, the FCC regulates decency, supposedly. And so radio stations have always thought that their licenses were in peril if they use certain language. Now, a new study, actual statistical study released by The Washington Post, finds that, surprising news, folks, profanity is a hallmark of Donald Trump's second term. A sharp increase in his use of vulgarities, insults, and bombastic rhetoric since his first term. Really a huge increase if you look at the numbers. And I'm looking at a bunch of charts that the Washington Post created to help tell the story, which is a very good idea these days.
Do they classify them by word?
Oh, no, they do not specifically break out the words. But it is interesting, in the print and digital version that I'm reading here, they actually use the president's own words that we cannot repeat here because his FCC would put us in peril, I think.
It's a different F.
FCC, as Colbert often points out, CBS. They put the BS in CBS. Anyway, so what do we think as journalists? How do we deal with this kind of thing when you've got the most important official of the country, at least, and formerly the leader of the free world, offering this kind of language?
Well, as someone who occasionally has to get cleaned up by our producer, David Gustina, I appreciate the house that sometimes unfortunately creeps. I'm not proud of it, but I also try to remember there's a time and a place if you're going to use something that's not appropriate. And it would be silly of us to think that leaders and ordinary people throughout the ages have not been using bad language. But there should be a bar for civil discourse and speech that you want to model for your country and for your other adults and for children. And when it's not happening that way, I think that in the media, we need to report what the president is saying with the appropriate bleep, like maybe an F blank 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 if that happens, because we want people to know how our president speaks publicly. But I feel badly about that too, because then we're normalizing that kind of speech.
You know, we used to have rules that we wouldn't publish in written form the profanity. We wouldn't publish them in part because we had such a broad audience, in part because we believed children may be reading it. And again, we wanted to bring down the civil discourse. And to be quite honest, I mean, local politicians, local officials very rarely used this kind of profanity. They just didn't. So when the first time I heard Donald Trump say something like this, I think it was in the first term. There was far less of this in the first term. I mean, I was shocked, but I think over time, especially in the second term, we have gotten used to it, and it doesn't get the kind of of reaction that it should be. I think there's a story here about how do you handle this with your children? What should you be telling your children about the kind of language you should use? That's at least one story we could write.
Public officials, you're right, used to be different about this. Richard Nixon was so embarrassed by the profanity that was revealed in the Oval Office tapes. The phrase that we now use, expletive deleted, actually was created for the transcripts of those tapes. Expletive deleted became a big deal because people suddenly found out that the president cursed in private. Imagine that. And there was an embarrassing moment when Dick Cheney was caught on a mic referring to a reporter with the F word. It was an embarrassing thing. Now, it's not embarrassing. The president's press office says, well, he doesn't care about political correctness. He cares about making America great again. That's their official response to the question about this.
Is it filtering down to other politicians yet? I'm not seeing a lot of this from Congress, people in Congress.
I think you are. Yeah, I think so. And it's a mark of authenticity. It's the kind of thing, for example, one of the Republican candidates in the 21st District, Anthony Constantino, is known to be, let's say, mimicking the president's terminology.
Right, and especially when dealing with reporters is some of the things.
And winning his endorsement, therefore. I think it maybe is a mark of Trumpism now. But it is hard. I'm tempted to encourage radio stations regulated by the FCC, as you say, to go ahead and why not push them?
Yeah, and it's an example of sane washing if we don't report that his language is what ordinary people would think is too the low bar for civil discourse, and that you don't want profanity, but you want to know that he's using it. Could make saucy headlines, but then you become numb to it, too, when it's over and over, these saying terrible.
We used to consider ourselves,
language,
of course, as arbiters and as standard setters in the media when our impact was more significant. I remember doing a story early in my tenure as editor of the Times Union, back at the beginning of this century, where we analyzed use of the N-word and how this had been creeping into discourse. And we actually used the word in the story in the context of writing about use of the word. Now we can't. You know, now we wouldn't do that because that is not part of the appropriate language that we would consider using. I wonder if that's going to change, since now if the president decides certain language is okay, would he redefine that standard as well?
And then it depends on the owners of media outlets of how they're going to handle that. And wow. And besides profanity, there's just terrible name calling. And some of it has caught on, but disparaging names, you know, calling somebody piggy and stupid. And
low IQ is one of Donald Trump's favorites, a low IQ individual.
You know, insulting language should not be part of any kind of leader's discourse, I don't think.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. So then
what do you do about that? We need to report that, too.
So, listeners, what do you think? media@wamc.org is how you can interact with us, and we're always happy to take your thoughts and make use of them. This is the Media Project of Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith with Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick. One of the things that we have done, the three of us as editors in newsrooms, is help reporters figure out what form a story ought to take. That is, how you'd write it. And one of the interesting things that we deal with is story structure. Sometimes elemental stories about what is going on can be told best in what's called the inverted pyramid. You just basically put the big stuff up top and you gradually get down to the less important stuff. Sometimes you have a direct lead, which tells people in the first 10 or 15 words what's going on and then goes on. And then we have a delayed lead, which is an anecdote or a metaphor or something that is
a scene setter, that's an example of what the story is about to be about.
Which gives rise to what is called the nut graph, three or four paragraphs in where you tell people what the story is really about. Now, there is a new study from Temple University's School of Business that found that how a story is told is what grabs readers' attention and keeps them engaged. So the design of storytelling turns out to be more important than the headlines, this study says. And I'm just intrigued by that. So what do we think about story structure? And does it matter anymore in the internet era? How you bring people into a story?
I laughed about the anecdotal lead because I've come to hate them. I want the news. You know, don't spin it for a few minutes. We went through this phase in our industry where everybody wanted to do narrative storytelling and could really captivate people and pull them in. I think that's less of an issue now because you have fewer people actually enjoying reading. And so I want them to get the information they need quickly and cut out all this nonsense about describing the person's demeanor. I think that can be done well by a really good reporter and a really good writer, but too often I see, especially anecdotal leads, are just wasted my time.
It really depends. Now, remember that the thing they see first is the headline, and they're going to look at whatever image was with the story and, you know, maybe glance at the caption. But the headline and the subheadline, the smaller type that usually has, it's almost like a sentence in itself sometimes, those things tell you that what the story is going to be about. And so if a story can be made, you know, want the lead to the story to just basically repeat what the headline just said. But if you can tell a story, an anecdotal lead or a scene setting lead, something short and sweet, unlike my remarks right now, something short and sweet, that could make the story more interesting because you're focusing on a real person telling their little micro story. And then in this third or fourth paragraph, it says, you know, they're one of, you know, 100,000 people who are experiencing whatever.
Yeah, so I like sounds them. Like Judy doesn't like that part so much, right?
Well, sometimes they go on too long to get to the point.
Yeah, if I'm on paragraph 10 and I still don't know why I'm reading this, I'm annoyed. Again, I have seen some wonderful writing in the narrative style, but you have to be very good at it to effectively pull it off.
Yeah, and it is too often used as a crutch by writers to get into a story, right? If you're not quite sure what you're actually going to be saying, it's easier to give yourself a little time to make your way into it.
Yeah, if you don't have the material to do it well that way,
yeah.
just tell the story. We had a community advisory board for a few years, a mix of citizens from Saratoga, and one of the exercises we did, and I stole it from some like Pointer or somewheres, where they had copies of the print paper and the green grease pencils that you could use to mark stuff up and just start reading the paper and draw a line where they stopped reading each article.
Uh-huh.
And it was humbling. And I was even selective about bringing it back to my staff saying, and then having staff do that themselves, these staff students do, where would you stop reading the story? You can do that online too.
Focus groups are always humbling, weren't they? When you listen to what readers actually said, or I remember the notion of sitting in a train station, say, or something, and watching somebody read your newspaper, and you just kind of cringe when you see somebody just skip over a story. They say, no, look, we worked really hard on that.
Online does this too. There are analytics that will show you how far into a story a reader will go, and like the percentage of people that make it to the bottom of an 18-inch story is under 10%, as I recall. It's, you know, it's that, again, is humbling. And it's also a reason for editors to say to the reporter, wrap it up.
Yeah. I think there's also justification for more stories to be written in a Q&A format with a question in boldface when it's a topic that you want people to be able to understand, or it's a sidebar to the, you know, other part of the story. Because you want your story to be able to answer questions that, what is the reader going to want to know? When is this project coming to the city board again? And what is it going to do? And how much is it going to cost me? And what's it going to do to my neighborhood? So a Q&A format as opposed to just a long narrative would be a better form.
I think our listeners might be interested to know that there is something, a divide in journalism these days about this issue. Axios, a powerful online news organization now, has pioneered what they call smart brevity. That is their trademark term, smart brevity. And what that just basically means is they number the different points. It is really like what we used to call a bulleted story. Mm-hmm. And they give you little boldface words that introduce paragraphs and guide you through a story that is just a little bit of a different way of presenting a story so that you don't worry about the transition sentences from one paragraph to the next. You just kind of deliver it really directly. And it seems to be a good tool. I think their research suggests it's a good tool for reaching the limited attention span of today's news consumers.
You know, I'm going to contradict myself here because when I look at those Axios stories and they're just skimming, I miss the writing. You know, I mean, I'm a lover of good writing, and there are stories that I never want to end because the writing is so entertaining and fascinating. But with Axios, it's like, Yeah, you gave me the basics, but I would love a little bit of
humanity. Well, that's so you get the best of both worlds, because some stories should be that way. That's maybe even a better approach than the Q&A or a similar approach to that. But you still want stories told about people. What does it mean to people? Told through real human beings. And smart brevity makes a lot more sense than, say, when USA Today started and they had their 100 or 200 word blurbs, and that was considered a story.
Yeah, that's true.
That was not smart. It was brevity, but it wasn't smart. but it would be enough for people to get the gist of what they wanted to know.
And the notion of USA Today, remember, it was a pioneer at an era when people were moving away from traditional print formats. And I guess the notion was, let's make something that can be quickly consumed by people, easier to take on. It's hard to remember back that far, but 40 years ago, USA Today was a rather revolutionary organization at its time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
It's interesting. So we're at a stage where the notion that people love stories, they love good stories, some stories demand to be told that way. I think if you're writing about the New York State budget, you could really lose readers at the first paragraph. When you say the governor's $248 billion state budget cleared a major hurdle, blah, 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 you have basically a paragraph that people read and say, okay, let me move on. That demands some sort of storytelling that will get people into it to understand why any of this has consequence for them, because otherwise it's just beyond boring. And we don't want to be boring, do we? The Media Project, Northeast Public Radio, is here. Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, and Barbara Lombardo, we are grateful to have you. Hey, here's a question raised by research from the Pew Knight Initiative, which is a couple of the leading foundations funding American nonprofit journalism. What does it take to be a good news consumer? You know, it's very hard these days in the news world because there are questions about news sources being inaccurate because they come from a point of bias. There are stark political divides in the news sources, the rise of artificial intelligence. So what does it take? It's really interesting what people say. 1 in 5 adults mention in their response to this questionnaire from the Pew Knight Initiative that Americans associate being skeptical or discernment as being part of a good news consumer. I appreciate that, right?
That's really all I want, or them to be discerning and then to be careful with what they do and not share stuff that their discernment has questioned.
That is a huge issue now that just keeps getting worse and worse, of people sharing AI-created fake videos. And yes, you want people to be skeptical. You want them to be consuming the news. I'm very skeptical of any of those kinds of studies because I think people reply to make it sound as if they follow the news more than they follow.
You are discerning, aren't you, Barb?
There you go. She is discerning of these studies. Well,
what the eight double hockey sticks are you talking about?
That is a really good point. The notion is that about half of adults say that it's extremely or very important to get news regularly. That's to your point, you know. And yet that is less common among young adults to get the news regularly. So while we think that that's important, it's not actually followed by a lot of people. And the question about people say you have to have quality news sources, but the challenge here is that people's views of what constitutes a quality news source varies widely depending on their political affiliation. So they may say, go to a quality news source, and they count that to be Fox News, which I would not say, but that's just a point of view. Hey, we have an interesting opportunity here to listen to one of our colleagues, and I think it would be interesting to hear our take on this after listening to a colleague. David Botter was a young Associated Press reporter in the New York State Capitol 35 years ago. He went on to become the media beat reporter for the Associated Press. David lives in the Hudson Valley and has just retired from the AP. And it's really interesting. Actually, I knew him when he was a young reporter at the Stamford Advocate in Connecticut. Yes, because I'm so old. But David retired, and you know, he was up in Albany recently. But he did an interview with the Pointer Report out of Florida and said that he was actually optimistic. Let's hear what David had to say.
The thing about journalists is instead of bemoaning, you know, states of the industry as much as we do, because it's been our job, you know, they put their head down and work because it's very important. They understand the importance of it and they love it. I mean, it's in your blood when you're doing stuff like that. And I think there are enough people that want to do that sort of thing that make me feel optimistic.
Well, that's really a great thought. And I wonder if that is something that we in this studio share, that kind of optimism. Do we feel optimistic about the future of the impact of journalism because there are people who want you to do the job?
Well, I think by nature, we are optimistic. And we believe in journalism, and we're hopeful that journalism continues. I think that's part of why we continue to have these kind of discussions and figure out how to have a media that people can afford to exist in. But if you listen to Botter's entire interview, which I did, he had some numbers that I wished I'd written down, but basically reasons to not be optimistic. There used to be maybe 20 years ago, 70,000 people who considered themselves roughly journalists in news. And now that number is 30,000 journalists who are working for news agencies. Actually, maybe it was 70% of people who are journalists working in news, and now it's 30%.
70% of the jobs that were going on in journalism 20 years ago are now gone. And that is really a significant drop in the number of journalists. And at the same time, the people working to influence journalists have risen. There are now 8 public affairs people working for every single journalist. So we are really deluged by information managers rather than the discerners, to use that word you had before, the people trying to discern the news and decide what's valid. So that's of concern. It's the structure of the industry rather than the practitioners that I think leads us to less of that sense of optimism.
I totally agree. And I think that's what David Botter was trying to get at, the idea that people are just putting their heads down and doing the work because the work needs to be done. But that being said, as long as I've worked in journalism, the practitioners thereof have always been griping about one thing or another. They've never been happy. You know, the coffee's not good, or somebody once made a joke to me that, you know, if a reporter won the lottery, they complain about how heavy the paper bags full of money were. So, that, you know, reporters are tend to be complainers.
I hope that was at the that was at the Gazette. Everybody was very happy at the Saratoga.
Yeah, right.
Just thrilled.
Oh, yeah.
But they do love the work. And I think you will always have journalists doing that. But, you know, in the last few years, it's hard not to be discouraged by the evaporation of especially local news and then the attacks on the national press. And even though some of the impediments we're facing as an industry now in terms of being censored and being having access restricted, I mean, there's always been some of that. It's just that it's so intensified now that it you know, you feel like you really need to fight to sustain our industry.
There is some great work going on. Last week in Albany, the Legislative Correspondents Association show went on in the Capitol, and that night...
You went to the show,
huh? I didn't go. No, I had something else I had to do. But I did go to the luncheon of the Legislative Correspondents Alumni Association beforehand. But there are two awards that are presented. One by the active reporters, which is judged by journalism professors, and one by the former reporters, the Alumni Association. And it's interesting to see the two different kinds of reporting that were rewarded. The Legislative Correspondents Alumni Association gave the award to John Campbell of New York Public Media and Gothamist, and his reports are heard here on WAMC. A lot of them are audio reports, but he also writes for Gothamist. He's been a longtime reporter, used to be the Gannett bureau chief in the Capitol. And New York Focus, Albany Bureau Chief Chris Bragg won the LCA Award for investigative reporting, really. So two different modes of reporting, both really high quality stuff that in any generation would have been considered great work, got awards. So you recognize the fact that there is some really great reporting going on, and we got to be grateful for that, right?
You can be grateful. I'm still worried.
Still worried. I think it's not inappropriate at all to be worried. But notwithstanding the effort, there are still cuts. We need to make note of the fact that even what people listening here probably find out, NPR is making cuts. A gap of $8 million in the $300 million annual budget of NPR is leading to eliminating some funding, eliminating some jobs who are now part of the NPR is offering buyouts to about 300 people. people in the newsroom. They will lose about 30. They say it'll take probably 1 in 10 of the buyouts. But it's tough with Congress cutting off the funding and with audiences migrating away from traditional news sources. These are tough issues for us to confront.
Well, that's ending on a positive note.
And that's all for today, folks. Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo here with me. I'm Rex Smith, with gratitude to the producer of the Media Project, David Gustina. And we thank you for joining us this week. Come back again next week, will you, for the Media Project.
When they know they've got a people's fight to wage, ting-a-ling-a-ling newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, and Raga Justin, Albany bureau chief for Bloomberg Government. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.